Before we get started, I'm going to say the my set-aside prayer. There's several of them. People ask me where I got it. I heard it from listening to a speaker, Fellowship of the Spirit 2001. By the way, we're passing the can. We have to pay rent, so if you can give more than a dollar, that would be greatly appreciated. If you can't, that's fine. God, set aside everything I think I know about you, God, the steps, recovery, the big book, what's best for me, what's best for others. Especially let go of all my old ideas so I can have a new spiritual experience and see your truth. Help me carry your message today. Amen. Okay, we started working with others on Saturday, and if you want to go through the whole big book, you go to the full podcast archives, or you go to Saturday, and you find November 2017. And 2 years later, we're on working with others. So either I talk too much, or we covered a lot. So it's a way, if you wanted to go through the book in order. History of the book, how it was put together, the whole deal. We covered two pages last week. This chapter... If you're new, you say, well, what does this have to do with my situation? But these are the spiritual principles. Remember, step 12 is practice these principles in all our affairs. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, we carry this message to others, especially alcoholics. And so in here is a reminder of what you need to carry, what you need to have done, and how you practice the principles in all your affairs. And it's different than it is today because this was written in 1938 and there was no AA and there was no big book. And how are they going to work with other people? Now they're telling you their experience, which was different. It's a different world. People lived in neighborhoods. They didn't have cars. They didn't have phones. America was broke in 1935, coming out of the Depression. Different world. But the same principles apply today. And so we did two pages, and I'm just going to read on the second paragraph on page 90. It says, wait for the end of the spree, or at least a lucid interval. It's good to talk to people when they're lucid. It's not a joke. I mean, really, you're not going to make sense. What we do now is a lot of times we get called, people are a mess, we get them to the hospital, we get them help so they can detox, right? We get them the medical attention they need, and then when they've recovered enough, then you help them. And in the old days when they admitted them, Dr. Bob left them alone for 48 hours. And then they went in and then they started working with them. They had a 5-day program. Cost $40, and a lot of times they had to pay the bill because the person didn't have any money. It says, if he wants to quit for good, ask him, and if he would go to any extreme to do so. This is a theme of the book. If people don't want to quit for good, and they're not going to go to any extreme to do so, then they haven't hit bottom. They're not completely defeated. Hitting bottom isn't when you get arrested 10 times. Hitting bottom is when inside you're completely defeated and you know you have no power to fix this thing, none. And then usually what I did was I got on my knees and I asked God for help. God seemed to have something I didn't have. And I remember as soon as I did that, I felt better. Because when you surrender, you get strength. And God starts to come to you when you give up and ask him for help. Go to any extreme to do so. Did we read that in How It Works ever? Are you willing to go to any length? So I've heard somebody say what any length is, and Mark's talked about that. Any length means any length. And then there's a surrender in the How It Works. We don't talk about it a lot. It says, remember, we have to let go of all of our old ideas, or the result is nil, and we have to let go, what's the word? Absolutely. So I find that if I hold on to my old ideas, they come up. and they bite me. Now, some of them are really stupid, but some of them have been killing me. The one old idea I had that killed me, and I wish I'd gotten rid of this a long time ago, was that if I tried to manage the world well, I would be happy. I kept trying. And I mean, I'm a good trier, but it just made a mess of everything. And once I stopped trying to run the world, realized that's never gonna work, then I was on my way. And so, but I'm always telling Mark how I didn't want to watch the show and it's no good. And then I watch it, it's great. So why was it no good 6 months ago and then great? And you know, I do that all the time. Restaurants, I don't want to go to that restaurant, it's no good. I've never been there, I go, it's great. You know, old ideas, it's fun. When you're in AA a while, like Chuck C used to talk about in his new pair of glasses, it's fun to see when you're wrong. It's good, what else am I gonna be wrong about? Because the more I'm wrong about, the more free I am. And the more right I am, the more I'm in bondage to myself. So I don't wanna be right anymore. It says, draw your attention to the person who is recovered. There's the word again, recovered. Recovered means that you're not under the dominion of alcohol today. You're not dominated by the obsession to drink. You have a power that can say, bad idea today, Michael. Now, recovered is not a permanent state. It has to be achieved all the time. And it can be lost. We see it all the time. It's happened to me and others. You should be described as one of a fellowship who, as part of their own recovery, try to help others. So our fellowship that they had was people who were recovered who were trying to help others. So everybody had worked the steps that went to the first meetings, and you had to do the third step up on your knees, and they voted on you if you were sincere enough before you could even go to the meetings. They worked the steps quickly, the steps that they had in those days. There's no formal book. They had the six steps of the Oxford group. But the key was to get quiet time into spiritual growth, studying scripture, and sharing it with other people, because there was only usually one meeting a week. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail, rarely followed our path. Anybody ever heard that before? Well, what was the path that they had before the big book? They didn't have a big book. Now I'm a big book thumper, and you know, I believe in the big book and it works if you do it and follow the directions. But before that, they didn't have that. What was the path they had? They studied scripture. They had quiet time. Experience. They shared their experience, strength, and hope. It was good. And then they put that experience into this and they formalized it. And this is great. It says, never force yourself upon him, because it won't do any good. It says the family shouldn't hysterically plead with him. They should wait for the end of this next drinking bout. Now here's a key line, it's hidden in the book. It said you might place this book where he could see it in the interval. They thought this book was important. This book was their directions, their experience, strength, and hope. This was their 12th step to the world. That's why I focus on this book, the AA Big Book. It's our basic text. It's a textbook of what they did, taking from their mind, so you can see what they did, so you can do it. Now, if you don't want to do it, they don't care. Don't buy the book, don't read it. But if you're defeated and you want what they have and you have a hopeless condition of mind and body, do this and tell us what happened. And Margie told us today. It's powerful. It says, here they talk about the family telling him my story. It's a different world now. If the man needs hospitalization, he should have it, but not forcibly unless he is violent. And then when he's better, you should go visit him. And it says on the second paragraph, call on him when he is still jittery. He may be more receptive when depressed. Mm-hmm. Depression is good when you come in here. If you're not depressed, there's something wrong with you when you come to AA. Now, this isn't the clinical depression that was taught to me in 1972 in medical school. Depression in those days, people couldn't eat, couldn't get out of bed, very severe. They couldn't function. They could not function, and they needed medication. My alcoholic depression was I ran the world, and it didn't work, and things didn't go my way, and it was depressing. Anybody else have that? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to give you a hint. If you stay in AA and you don't work the steps, you're going to get depressed. Mm-hmm. Now, if you go to a doctor, they're going to give you a pill, because there are like 20 or 30 pills for depression. And I don't know if they'll help you or not. I have no opinion on that. But I know what will help you if you're depressed and you're an alcoholic, if you're not working the steps, and that's to get in the book, sponsor someone and work the steps. And that will treat your depression. Now that, don't somebody write me, well, I said you shouldn't take medicines. I'm not talking about that. But we should be depressed when we're running the world because it doesn't go our way. Isn't that what 60 to 63 says? It didn't work. So see the man alone if possible. After a while, turn to some phase of drinking. Tell him about your drinking habits, symptoms, and experiences to encourage him to speak of himself. And isn't that what the big book does up to page 43? It talks about the obsession of the mind, the allergy of the body, the queer mental twist that precedes the first drink. Encourage him to speak of himself. Somebody, Eric called me. Eric from North Carolina, and he was actually meeting with somebody. He's really excited. He's going to sponsor somebody. And he wanted to know what to do. And I said, let him talk, because that's what I'd never do. Let him talk. Let him tell you about themselves and what they're doing and where they are and about their life. Let him talk, and then tell him a little bit about where you were when you came in. And he called me back. He said it really, really went well. He's doing very well, by the way. If he's a serious mood, dwell on the troubles liquor has caused you, not him. Being careful to moralize or lecture, and that's hard. We want him to have it so badly that we want to convey to them how powerful this is, but they have to want it on their own. It has to be a process. They have to have a change in heart, change in mind. When he sees you know all about the drinking game, commence to describe yourself as an alcoholic. Now, remember, before this book was written, very few people knew what was wrong with alcoholics. They knew we were a mess and we should be avoided at all costs, and that we did really insane, stupid things, and nobody could help us. But what makes us an alcoholic is the loss of control once we drink, right? Because everybody in this room, if we had one drink, we'd all want a second one. I've always wondered if we brought in a couple kegs and we let everybody loose, what the parking lot would look like in 2 hours. And it wouldn't be enough booze, right? And so it would never be enough. And then we have the loss of choice. I cannot decide on my own not to drink today. Anybody else have that? Now that's important to remember, because if I know that I don't have any choice to drink today, then I'm going to seek God when I wake up. I'm going to start praying. I'm going to do my meditation. I'm going to start working my recovery that day. I don't want to forget that I don't have any choice on my own. Now, for a while I thought I had choice. I didn't understand the program. And then I was doing really well. You know, I'm going to meetings and my life's getting better. But that's not the power that's going to keep you from drinking, because at a certain time, your mind's going to say, I need a drink, because if you're not God-centered, you're going to lead a self-centered life, and you're going to get irritable, restless, and discontent. You're going to have that bad moment. And that bad moment, before you know it, you're drinking. You don't even remember how you got there. And so loss of control, loss of choice, the queer mental twist that tells us it's okay to drink. Did anybody have that? Now, there's nothing that I know of that will treat the queer mental twist except God. And if you have a relationship with God, God will say, bad idea. I don't think you should drink today, Michael. Why don't you call somebody? Stop complaining. Be grateful. Get out of yourself. You get it? And so those are the things that makes you an alcoholic, and they're not going to get into the self-centered nature of our alcoholism on the first visit, because that's lecturing the guy. You're self-centered. You're a mess. Well, I've said that, but it doesn't help them. And it's not... It doesn't helpful. They have to come to it on their own through reading the book. So once they're well enough, you can have them read 60 to 63 and go through it with them and say, this is true for you. That's why the book is so powerful. Tell them how baffled you were. Anybody baffled? There you go. Just turn the lights off. How did you finally learn you were sick? You see, that's a good question. How did you learn you were sick? When you kept doing these things and you couldn't stop, could that be it? You did things you didn't want to do. You did things that you didn't want to do. And then you did them anyway. And then you did them and you said, well, damn, that happened again. And it's a process. And then you can learn you're sick and forget it the next day. See, that's where our ego rebuilds. So it's such a dangerous disease because you could be sick on Monday and then think you got it on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. And you see that all the time when new people come in. They know they're sick. They know their lives are a mess. And after 30 days, they say, well, I'm feeling better. You know, I'll come once a week. I can go to one meeting a week. It changes. That's why it's a fatal disease, because our mind is killing us by giving us old ideas that we believe. Give them an account of the struggles you made to stop. Anybody struggle to stop? Show them the mental twist which leads to the first drink of a spree. And this is really important. And it says, we suggest you do this as we have done in the chapter on alcoholism. And we spent 3 meetings on that chapter, and it's so powerful. Because what it tells us at the end of that chapter on page 43, there's a final paragraph that they want to hammer home. And it says, you have no defense against the first drink except from God, basically. And then you have to look at that and say, is that true? And if it's true, then the rest of the book is how you find that power. Because on page 45, it says, now we're going to talk about God. Why? Because I need a power to live, and I don't have it. So you see how the book works? They spent a lot of time on the first step. Don't at this stage refer to the book unless Yacina wishes to discuss it. And be careful not to brand them as an alcoholic. And I've heard people say, you're never supposed to tell anybody they're an alcoholic. Well, that doesn't say that. Be careful not to brand him as an alcoholic. Let him draw his own conclusion, because he has to draw his own conclusion anyway. But Dr. Bob and Bill went to AA number 3, and they said, you're an alcoholic. And so you can tell him that, but he has to draw his own conclusion. People telling you that you're alcoholic won't help you. You have to know it. Remember, what's the first step in recovery? We have to fully concede to our innermost selves that we're an alcoholic. The idea that we're like normal people has to be smashed. So how do I fully concede my experience and my pain? And I can't fully concede for you. Now, we want to, don't we? We love people. We see people. We want to help. But I can't fully concede for them. They have to fully concede. I think we should call it the Fully Concede Club. The Fully Concede Club will do everything in Chapter 5 and 6 and won't drink again. But if you're not fully conceded, you won't go to any length. It says, insist that if he's severely afflicted, there may be little chance he can recover by himself. Remember, we cross that invisible line. So how do you know when you can't recover by yourself? It says in the big book, they say it really nice. They're too nice. They say if you're a real alcoholic, you can't recover on a non-spiritual basis. Now, what do they mean by that? They mean that going to meetings, fellowship, society, therapy, isn't the power. It has to come from God. Now, those things can lead you to God and lead you to a relationship with God, but it has to be living on a spiritual basis. Remember, it says the spiritual life is not a theory, right? We have to live it, and we talk about that. So if you cross that invisible line, the only thing that can save you from the queer mental twist is your relationship with what we call God, power greater than yourself. So the whole book is really about a relationship with God. And the relationship with God is what changes my life. And the relationship has to be maintained 24 hours a day, all the time. You don't get a certificate, and God gives you a certificate and said, we got it now, Michael. No, because we separate all the time in our mind. He gave us free will. So we have to get back to him. And we talked about that Wednesday. It's a process. Continue to speak of alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady. Fatal malady. Is that bad? So people always make a fun of me because I told somebody that they're going to die. They said, Michael said, I'm going to die. And everybody laughs and thinks I'm an asshole. But Excuse me. What I meant was, if you're not going to change your behavior, if you're not willing to do this, you know, this is a fatal disease. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with telling people it's a fatal disease, but me telling them that won't change them. Now, I did notice in my cancer practice, if I told people that this was a really bad disease, and you wouldn't need to come Wednesday at 8 and start treatment, they were always there. In fact, they were there 5 minutes early because they could understand it and they wanted the treatment. But when we tell people it's a fatal disease, a lot of times alcoholics will say, well, I'm not that bad yet. He's talking about him, not me. And so it's something that we have to realize, but until we realize it, it won't. See, all of this is about what you have to realize if you're the new person. Talk about the conditions of the body and mind, which we talked about. Our body's damaged. It never gets better, does it? Does our mind ever get better? No. Remember, an alcoholic alone is in dangerous company. And we have to treat our mind all the time with steps 10 and 11. But we can't do that until we've done 4 through 9. And we've made a decision in step 3. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience, because that's all we have. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Now, that's a powerful line. We read that in every meeting, in how it works. There are those who cannot and will not do this simple program. Those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They cannot see their predicament. Now, what is their predicament? They're going to tell us. You may talk to them about the hopelessness of alcoholism because you offer a solution. Isn't that what they do in the first paragraph of the big book, the foreword, the first thing they wrote, 1939? We are 100 men and women who have a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. To tell you exactly how we recovered is the purpose of this book, the first lines. So if you have a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, you might want to follow the directions in the book. Now, if you have your own plan, that's fine, but most people don't. So they do this. Now, the key word in there is seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body, because it seems hopeless, but it's not, because they recovered. So this is actually a book of hope. We're not telling everybody they're going to die all the time so they go home and get depressed. We're telling them to die. They're going to die without the solution in this book. And that we hope that they'll do it, and we offer a solution. So whenever you give news about hopelessness, you have to give a solution. I had to do that all the time. I'd see people with really bad things. And I know they're coming in, and it's going to be worse. And I had to think about, when I woke up, what I was going to tell them. What was the next plan? How I could give them some hope with this terrible situation. And so that it's hard to do. But with alcoholics, it's easy. Because once you can see the hopelessness, then you'll want to go to any length, right? And you'll be willing to do this. You will soon have them admitting he has many, if not all, the traits of an alcoholic. Now, it says, even though your protege, that's where they got this word protege, is a person who is guided or supported by a more experienced person. And I think that one of the things is that's gotten changed is they didn't see themselves as superior to anybody. The sponsor-sponsee relationship, it was a vertical, it was horizontal. They were walking hand in hand. They weren't any better. They had the disease, but they had a solution. And so the protege is someone who you guide through what you found the solution, which is what the book does, right? He has become very curious to know how you got well. So that's really what you're supposed to have them figure out, is that you were a mess and you're better. So how did you get well? Now on page 20, it's a really important question that nobody's really ever asked me. It says, in the first paragraph, you're reading the book. It says, you may have already asked yourself why it is that you became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless, if you're reading the book, you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of extrovert opinions to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. Isn't that you're reading this book, these people have something. That's what we're supposed to do, the meetings when new people come in, right? We're supposed to tell them, you know, look what's happened to us, look how we've changed. And it's you're an alcoholic, and here's the key, who wants to get over it. You may be already asking, what do I have to do? So when you see a new person, ask them if they ask you, well, what do I have to do? Usually they'll tell you what they're willing to do or what they think they should do. But what do I have to do? And Sandy Beach says, really, that's the only question you have to ask if you're new. What do I do next? And isn't that what the book does? It's a sequence. What do I do next? And guess what it says? It's the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. They're going to tell you, what do you do? Specific directions. So if you're new, everything you need is in the book. And I read this book, and the guy says, if you do everything in chapter 5 and 6 and you continue to do it the rest of your life, you'll never drink. That's steps 3 through 11. Then you practice step 12. Let him ask the question. Tell him exactly what happened to you. So that's where you have you can help somebody. And then you have to have the solution to be able to tell them what you did. And so a lot of people get sponsors. But if you get a sponsor, ask your sponsor, well, what did you do? What can you show me? What do I need to do? Have they done the steps? Have they worked the book? This and that. Can they tell you what they did? Tell them exactly what happened to you. That's in squiggly writing. Notice the word exactly what happened. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic. He does not have to agree with your conception of God. Remember? We don't like to get religious here. We can talk about my conception of God, but I can't tell you that that has to be your conception. But here's the thing. He can choose any conception he likes. But look what they say, provided it makes sense to him. And I heard a speaker says, it has to be something that can make sense to you at 3 in the morning when things are looking bad and that you could talk to and you can go to. And the main thing, here it is, squiggly writing, is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. So the way the book's written, there's always, they give you one thing and then they give you the condition. Anybody willing to believe in a power greater than yourself? A lot of people are. They pray every morning, right? And then their lives are still an effing mess. Why? Because they're not living by spiritual principles. Now, I didn't know how to live by spiritual principles. Did you know when you came in here? I had spiritual principles. They were my spiritual principles. They got me a wristband. But the big book gives you spiritual principles and how you live by them. And Norm's not here today, but he always says, like, the big book tells us how we be, and this book tells us how we do that. This is a book of directions, so living it by spiritual principles. When dealing with a person, you better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use in arousing any prejudice, so don't get religious with them. Don't tell them what they have to believe. Don't force my conception on them. Stay away from religious dogma. Somebody had a problem when somebody mentioned Jesus at a meeting, and everybody carried on. If I mention Jesus as my higher power, that shouldn't bother you. I don't tell you what you have to believe, but it worked for me. And so we don't have to stay away from that, but I can't tell you what you have to do. Here's just one last paragraph that finishes up. A lot of people have had religious training. They believe, they pray. He may be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked. Now, that's a good point. Why, if I'm praying and believing in God, it hasn't worked? And why yours seem to work so well? Well, here it is. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. And here's a key line in the big book. To be vital, to be necessary for life, Faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Faith without works is dead for the alcoholic. See, we have to practice our faith through our works, or else our faith dies. And what it means, faith without works dead, that they talk about in the big book, is if my faith is dead without the works, I don't have that power at a certain time that I'm going to need to tell me it's a bad idea to drink. Does this make sense? So we want to keep that power alive and working in our life, and we do that through self-sacrifice and unselfish construction. And it says, he may know more about it, but the fact that however deep your faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. And so it's all about practicing the spiritual principles as a result of your faith, then you trust God. And then when you trust God, you have more faith, and then you practice more spiritual principles. So it's a circle. And so faith alone won't do it. We're not talking about religious salvation and New Testament dogma. We're talking about AA here. My belief and faith in God without trust and allowing him to work in my life won't do me any good. It's just lip service. So I can pray and chant for 5 hours, get in the car and be self-centered, and then act on my thoughts and have a miserable day. Does anybody relate to that? So we have to practice these principles all the time. We're going to stop there. We'll pick up next week on page 93. I'll make a mark so I don't review too much. Thank you, Margie. Way to go.